Hey, this is John Manna for the Worship Drummer podcast, and I'm so grateful to bring to you this conversation. We have Brandon Green joining me from my province. I think this is actually a first, Brandon.
Amazing.
You're up in Newmarket, Ontario, if I remember correctly.
45 minutes away, man. Let's go.
Yes. So one of the reasons why I'm very excited to have this conversation and to share it with all of you is, you know, in church world, our context, you know, we have church drummers who play, some of them very irregularly, once a week, one service. And then we have guys who are touring musicians from Nashville, you know, that's where their home is. And they like never stop playing. And so, you know, we go from irregular to like nonstop and in between as well. So, and not just church world. I know that some of you listening or watching, you just love drums and you've landed on the Worship Drummer podcast or on our YouTube channel. So this conversation applies to all of you. Brandon is, I took this off your bio. So if there are any tweaks to it, he's a passionate biomechanics specialist, fitness educator, a gym owner, and especially a drummer. And let me just set the stage and then I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions. But, you know, as someone who suffered with a bulged disc and I've re-aggravated that injury probably four or five times, not even doing crazy work, just like a wrong tweak, putting a dish in the dishwasher but bending the wrong way, been on my back, you know, on the couch for like 2 or 3 weeks. There we go.
Ready for you.
And what I've loved when I landed on your YouTube channel is I've never heard someone teach, you know, and I have a chiropractor, so he'll pull out like all the spinal cord examples and this is what your back is doing. But you're explaining it from a drummer's perspective and understanding. So that to me spoke, you know, in leaps and bounds. And I said, okay, we're going to bring my mission over the last year was to reach out and to bring you to all of our worship drummer friends. So this is the conversation. And that's a lengthy intro, but I just wanted to say that and then get out of the way. But what I love to ask as we get started is, like, this is my first time interacting with you. So just maybe give us a bit of your background as a drummer and even like in what you do professionally and how those two worlds coincide.
Well, I started off as a passionate drummer, to be quite honest. I started playing when I was 12, 13. I became super, super obsessed with all of the technical superstar drummers. Like, I really loved the Mike Mangini's of my time, Thomas Lang's, like all these guys who did crazy physical things, because it was just, you just never saw anybody do it. Like, there was the playing music and then there were these technical athletes on the drum set that just blew my mind. And I fell in love with both of it because watching Trey Cool, Travis Barker's, all these, that's my era, right? Watching these guys crush it, playing music, it was amazing to see them perform. And then you saw people like Thomas Lang playing sextuplets with his feet at an incredible tempo while he's doing stick tricks just comfortably. And Mike Mangini playing time signatures over top of one another. It blew my mind. I became obsessed very quickly. I became so obsessed I wanted to figure out every single little nitty gritty detail. And I was 100% committed to going to school at Humber, right? Humber for School of Jazz. I was going to do the jazz program at Humber. I was going to go for all of it and really go deep.
Let's go.
I've talked about this a few times. I have my family is, there's a lot of Jewish entrepreneurs on one side of my family. And one of them specifically came to me and said, listen, I know you love drums. He brought an accountant over and the accountant was like, listen, I have a couple of professional drummers I work with and I just need to show you. And he showed me some numbers. And I was like, these look like great numbers. He goes, yes, but these numbers can't buy a house. Say, you should make this a passion project and have a career. And I was a little bit dissuaded by that and pretty bummed. Truthfully, I was going to go to school for firefighting. That was my next, that was kind of like my backup plan. And so I needed a credit in high school to go to firefighting. So I went and did a co-op at a gym to get in shape for firefighting. And that was when I was 17 years old. And going through that, I discovered this incredible mentor, this guy named Mario, who was obsessed with biomechanics. He was really into, there was this program called the Resistance Training Specialist Program by Tom Purvis, who is a physical therapist. He's designed equipment for NASA. He's one of the inventors of Bowflex, like just a mechanical wizard. And he just inundated me with all this information, and it blew my mind, because all of a sudden, exercise and fitness wasn't just about bodybuilding and cardio and running and weight loss, but it was really about helping people. This gym was 40 years old. It had a bunch of 40-year-old members. So geriatrics were in there, 70, 80-year-olds old with arthritis, herniated discs, major back problems, major problems. And as such, as I started studying more biomechanics and more fitness, I learned that I could use exercise to help people, right? It took people when they finish their physical therapy program, when they finish surgery, they're preparing for surgery. They have an advanced crazy disease, cardiovascular disease. They have cancer. There's so many applications where resistance training and getting stronger strategically can be really, really helpful, but it can't just be the one size fits all approach. It can't just be like, this is how you bench press, right? Everyone knows the rules of a bench press, arms at your side, put your hands here, 90 degrees, da, da, da. That's not true, right? Those are just pre-constructed notions of pre-choreographed things that we've learned. And so it really comes down to joint angles and mechanics. And really, without getting all so verbose, individuality. And so it was cool. That's launched the 18-year career where I've been using exercise to help people, mostly with pain and problems. It's brought me to NHL. It's brought me to professional drummers. It's brought me to the local hospital, collaborating with medical professionals in town. It's brought me to Portugal, teaching exercise science to trainers last May, really internationally teaching for the last 12 years, biomechanics to trainers. I've been teaching for a long time. I've invented my own courses. I have a business program for trainers called Fitness Pro Mentors. It's a lot of stuff. Wow. But the thing about all of the stuff that I do, that's not really supposed to be like a flex. It's more to be like, all of it comes down to one thing: individuality. How do we create exercise to help this person in front of me? And that's the most wonderful thing. So I'm still playing drums every day. It's still my favorite thing to do. It is my active meditation. I will go into the room and I'll play music. Last night, I was practicing foot ostinatos in 4 with 3 on my left hand and getting my right hand improvising in 3, 4, and 5. And I love that mental math. But I also love the physicality of challenging myself and pushing myself further and further. So it was about 6 or 7 years ago, one of my friends, a local drummer in Newmarket, hurt his back, ironically enough. And he wrote on Facebook. In high school, he was the drummer, right? I mean, you know, in high school, like there's the guy that is the drummer, even though you play drums, but there's the drummer guy. And you're like, I want to be that guy. He was the guy. And he wrote on Facebook, I think 7 or 8 years ago, F the drums. The drums hurt my back. Because of my back, I'll never play drums again.
Wow.
And for me, I was deep into my career. I just opened my gym and I was doing all this stuff. And I was like, this is absolutely insane. There's no way that this beautiful art that makes so many people happy and so fun and so cool should ever stop someone from doing that thing. That's like someone painting, knowing that the painting is going to hurt them one day and they have to stop. So I created a couple of YouTube videos, which I think you probably saw a few of them, a couple that went viral. And it was really just sharing everything I talk about day to day with geriatrics. And I had an NHL guy at 8 a.m. this morning, like all this stuff with drummers.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's so much more simple to talk to drummers because the stuff I talk about today about nociceptive responses and talking about post-activation potentiation and motor learning, like that's day-to-day jargon. But this is just bringing it down. Like, how do you take someone who doesn't need to know any of that stuff and give them what they need to know? And at the end of the day, there are 3 fundamental things these drummers really need to know: the geometry of the thing they sit behind, their ergonomics, the efficiency is really important. If they position things in places that does not allow their body to move naturally efficiently, right? That's what ergonomics means, efficiently. They're likely to have problems, right? If you sit in a car seat that's too low or too high or too short, it's going to hurt your back. Drums are the same. 2, if you don't have the physical conditioning and skills to do the things that you want to do on the drums, you are likely to sustain an injury, or you want to play fast, but you haven't worked on things to play fast, you're probably going to get hurt. If you play fast, but you have to play an hour-long game and you only play 30 minutes a time element, you're probably going to get hurt. Maybe you play within an hour and you're really good at it, but then you don't recover enough the next day, you're going to get blisters and hurt. So you have to figure out, how do you build up the conditioning to tolerate the levels of activity you want to do? And then 3, which is the more advanced level, is that the stronger and healthier you get outside of what we explore when we see a drum teacher and even play drums, right? Working on your fitness, your health, your everything longevity will extend your career so you can play longer and longer because stronger drummers play longer. But that's kind of like extra, right? The base level is you got to make sure the positions of the stuff that you play is in a good spot so it doesn't hurt you. And then you got to make sure your body can actually do the things that you physically want to do before you start expressing art. If you can't hold a paintbrush, you're not going to be able to create art. And so that's just been a lot of fun. So there's the YouTube channel on Instagram. I've been doing this for a while. I've been really kind of looking at myself as an open source information because I'm just trying to share as much as I can to help people. I got some stuff coming out that I'm excited about, as I'll talk about later. But at the end of the day, I believe there's no reason drummers should ever get injured from playing drums. And I'm going to do everything I can in my wheelhouse to make sure that doesn't happen.
I love that, man. So I want to unpack a little bit about what you were talking about with the geometry, physical conditioning, and just getting healthier and stronger overall. And just for those watching, we didn't like script anything from this conversation. So I'm just, we're going down the rabbit trails. I've interviewed a whole bunch of drummers and musicians already on this podcast. Two stick out in my mind, just as you're talking about the geometry and, you know, our posture, the setup of our stuff. Garrett Goodwin used to play for Carrie Underwood. So I interviewed him on the podcast and we talked about how he sets his kit up leaning forward. Daru Jones, I think, is another guy who sets it like really low and like literally tilted more than 45 degrees, I believe. And then, so it's like everything's low and tilted. Then the other side, and for our listeners, Elevation Worship, Vincent Baynard, where now they started putting their cymbals higher to isolate, you know, mic bleed, cymbal bleed into the tom mics and stuff like that. So two very different things to talk about, but I'm interested in your opinion of either side of those, because I said, man, how do you hit your cymbals so high? And it's like, well, working with sound techs, because we want optimal sound, but like, where's the balance of, yes, we're going for optimal sound, but optimal health and like everything you're talking about in terms of the geometry of our setup?
I mean, you bring up a real fundamental problem with beyond drumming, right? Because how many people are forced into geocentric environments that they don't fit in, right? You take someone that sits on an airplane seat and you take someone who, forgetting about an activity, you take a 6'8" person and you put them into a traditional air seat that's designed for the average height individual, they're going to be forced into a position that they don't like. So do they spend an extra $1,000 to go first class to get the knee space? Well, what if they can't afford it? What do? Do you buy two seats and go sideways? Do you get the fire exit? So there's a challenge where I think each, this is a lot that we come back to individuality first and foremost, right? I think whomever the person is, the actual adjustments and ergonomics needs to be built around that individual, right? My wife is 5'2", right? If she's going to sit behind a 22-inch kick, she's going to have to do something creative with the rack toms to get them low enough so she's not playing them right in front of her. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If we take the two extremes you spoke about between the low instruments and the high instruments, I can't speak to the individual scenarios, of course, of, hey, I sound engineer wants this, my body wants this. But I'm going to, because I'll speak into the body bias and then we could talk about politics. I have no idea what to do with that, to be honest. But here's what's really important to think about is that when you take a drumstick, for example, and you strike the surface of the instrument, right? If I strike, like if I take David and Goliath, he's got the sling, right? And he throws a stone at Goliath and David throws it, right? He has the sling at a 90 degree angle to the direction he wants the stone to go, because that's just sling mechanics, right? If I have it like this, it's going to go at a 90 degree angle to this. Well, there's the reason why is there's a 90 degree right angle, tangential angle, which is required for kinetic energy to transfer in a rotary environment, which is what the sling is. Put the words aside, what does that all mean? That's a bunch of gobbledygook. When I take the drumstick, right? If I strike the drum, this is not a drum, this is a notepad, so there's no bounce here, right? If I strike it and the tip of the stick is going this direction to the pad at a 90 degree angle, I'm going to get the most accurate rebound possible, the most efficient rebound, because the stick strikes the instrument, the rotary environment's at my finger where there's an axis, the fulcrum, everyone calls it, and then it's going to bounce back. And I can even do push pull on this at this angle with no rebound because I'm getting some rebound.
Mm.
When I change the angle of the instrument, now some of the energy is going down and some of the energy is going into the instrument. So the rebound won't be as accurate, right? Obviously, so if I'm here, if you're watching the video at a 90 degree angle, perfect rebound. If I go completely perpendicular, well, this is obviously not going to work. But you can see what I mean is that there's nothing here to absorb the energy. So as I start to change the angle slightly, I hit a little bit more, but some of it's pushing into the instrument. So for me, everything comes down to two parts as far as setting things up. I shouldn't say two, but one. Two, broadly speaking. One, that the angle of the instrument is the angle of the stick hitting the instrument is at a 90 degree angle when it strikes to get the most efficient return and make the stick do the most return.
Yeah.
Two, the body positions are set up such that they receive the least amount of force 80% of the time. I'll explain what I mean in a moment. So that my body doesn't get tired or the risk of injury gets lower. If I take my wrist, right? If you have my wrist here, this, and in the video, I'm having my wrist completely straight, like I'm holding a karate chop. If I bring my hand back all the way, this is as far as my wrist can go. Once I get to the end here, I feel tightness at the back of my wrist. My wrist is fully extended. If you were to come and push my wrist back further, it hurts back here.
Yeah.
Because my joints can't go any further. The bones cannot go any further. So if I'm playing an instrument, regardless of the two setups, and my wrist is cocked back all the way, and I'm hitting it at that angle where my wrist cannot go any further, you can expect to receive some joint damage because your bone can't go any further, and the instruments are trying to push reaction force, Newton's third law, back into you to actually potentially, so that could cause some damage because there's nowhere else for the energy to go. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of other examples there. So when you talk about high stuff, I don't think there's anything wrong with high stuff. Like if you see behind me right now, I've got a really high, like this ride cymbal here is really quite high for me, but it's set up such that if I have my elbow at the side of my body and I raise my elbow up just a little, I'm striking the ride right here at a 90 degree angle. So I'm not really reaching that far to make that happen, right? Mm. If you look at Terry Bozzio's OG kits, right? He's got roto toms and rack toms that are like up here, but they're like right here. So when he plays them, he's literally playing them really like right here where his wrists are in a good spot and he's not reaching that far, right? He's not reaching out all the way out here, even though that looks kind of cool. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So on the high end, I think there's a continuum of ridiculously too high, too much work for the individual. There's no need for it. And then there's a continuum of this is within your window of opportunity of what your body can do on the high end. Does that make sense?
Yes. So to not cut you off, but to our listeners, you know, what I observe in church world is, you know, you have elevation worship. That's the drummer I'm talking about who plays a little higher now. And we go, oh, they put their cymbals up, so we're going to move ours up. There must be, you know, a reason why they do it.
Right.
So it's just copying without maybe understanding why.
This is the problem.
Yeah. So that I just want to put that out there as you continue to explain.
So I wrote for Modern Drummer for 2 years straight, which was super cool. And the first article I did was don't copy other people's drum sets. Because how many people go, I love Travis Barker, flat ride, 14 feet up, flat crash cymbals, 15 feet up, and they're crashing on the ride cymbal. They don't even play the bell, right? And they're doing the arm swing back and forth because that's what he did.
Yeah.
Right. And I did it too. Right. I did flat crash because I'm like, that's what you're supposed to do. Right. Chris Coleman and Annika Nealis 7 or 8 years ago did the angled away from you cymbal. How many people did that? Angled cymbals away. Now, no, almost nobody's doing that. So there's trends that come and go, right? Snoms, right? People, anyway, whatever, you can copy. So there's so many different trends that people copy because they saw people that were their heroes do it. And that's what people do, right? I wear Michael Jordan shoes because Michael Jordan wore them and it made him a great basketball player. No, but that's how consumers think. It needs to be built around you. Because even if you and I are both 5'10", and I reach my arm out and my arm span is 24 inches. Yours might be 36 inches because some people have longer, that's exaggerating, but some people have longer arms than others. Yeah. Therefore, your reach is much further than mine. So your rack tom can be in a different position than mine. But that's, even though we're the same height, our proportions are different. So that's a great point you bring up. Very anyway, cool. I got one more thing. So you're talking about the high and low. So on the low end, right, this is, I see this quite a bit, and I don't want to speak to anybody's drum set specifically because I don't know for sure, but there was a driving instructor I had when I was learning how to drive in Canada when I was 16 years old. This lady named Pam in a Toyota Yaris, and it scared the crap out of me. It had the all-wheel steering. But the one thing she did teach me that I really remember well was you will lean and turn and look where, sorry, you will turn and lean where you're looking.
Yeah.
And so I would look to the left and I would turn the car to the left, and I look to the right and my car turned the car to the right. And so when you have things down and low, I think there's a point, like if you're playing traditional grip, like DeRue Jones, the snare drum, right? You can kind of just drop your hand and you can get the angle of the snare drum. But then there's a point when the rack tom's out in front of you, you actually have to reach away from you and then come back. I do think that some of those low setups look very cool. Without knowing the individual and more data, I think they're inefficient in a lot of cases, but then there's also times that they are efficient. Like I think DeRue Jones' snare drum, for example, I think he does a brilliant job. But then if you watch him try to move from the snare drum to the floor tom, like he was just trying to do in a simple roll, you got to go over the leg.
Yeah.
And so there's a point of diminishing return depending on what your goal is. He plays it very well. I don't know Carrie Underwood's old drummer's specific setup, but at the end of the day, if it works for them, great.
Yeah.
And if it's within their window of opportunity of what their body can do, great too. If it's not, then I think there's some questions that could be had if they wanted to have that conversation.
Love it. And anything else on geometry that you would love to touch on? Like I know one of your videos like talks all about the drum throne. I think it was a multi-part series.
We got a lot of drum throne stuff. So many people, everyone loves to talk about the drum throne. You know what? Here's what I would say. We have this thing, like I talked about the airplane seat, where snare drums are 14 inches wide mostly, right?
Yeah.
And you put hardware on it, they get like 15, 16 inches wide. That's cool. For a person who is really small, like again, my wife being 5'2", having a 16-inch snare drum between her knees actually opens her legs into abduction really far, which might be uncomfortable for some people.
Yeah.
And then for someone taller, like a 6'6" person, a 14-inch snare drum is really nothing. Why I bring that up is because the geometry of a lot of these instruments, right? They sell shell packs of a 14 by 5.5 snare drum with a 16-inch rack and a 12-inch rack and a 16th floor and then a 22-inch kick, right? These are cool configurations and are standards, but is it possible that these standards might actually hinder the individual? And should we be considering purchasing drum sizes or modifying the shape of the drum set to ensure that our body can be in more advantageous positions, right? I think rack toms and shallow toms absolutely have a place for someone who is shorter because they don't have to worry about it going up as high. Yeah. While someone who is 6'6", they can get away with really like crazy 14-inch by 14-inch rack tom if they really wanted to because they got the height.
Yeah.
So I get questions all the time when I start to share this idea of active range of motion, assessing what your body can do. I think it's cool. You need to make sure you're working within your window of opportunity. But they say, my drum set won't let me do it. Maybe it's time to change some of the material you've got to make sure your body's in a happy spot.
Because
if you're wearing shoes and you're like, I love my sandals, but they hurt my feet. Okay. Seems like you just answered your question. Anyway, I'd say there's so much more to talk about that, but just a little food for thought.
Yeah. No, that's cool. Okay. And by the way, we'll link to your YouTube channel and we'll make sure that anyone who wants to watch those videos, they'll find them. Heel up or heel down was something that I just jotted down. Is one more beneficial than the other in your professional opinion in terms of like health and posture?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think there's a trade-off with both. I think like if you're like, I'm obsessed with making sure my back is receiving the least amount of force possible, I think heel down is probably a better way to go. However, if you really want to get the most out of what your feet can do to help contribute to the instrument, I think heels up is the way to go. I play heels up. I practice heels down. The challenge you have with heels down, depending on the type of music, is you do lose the amount of power that you can produce because you're relying purely on the dorsiflexion to plantar flexion action of your ankle. So you're using much smaller muscles if you don't want to lift your heel up. When your heel is up, you do get that same ankle, but you also get leg weight involved, which is really a big deal. If you've checked out some of my videos, one of the most important things I think drummers need to do from a posture perspective and a bass drum perspective is sit in the middle of the drum throw. Because I've seen many people ask, should I sit on the edge? Should I sit on the back? Or should I sit on the middle? I believe, I shouldn't say believe, I know from assessing and playing with toys of metrics like scales and dynamometers, when you're in the middle of the drum throne, the majority of your weight's going through the throne, which makes the aggregate weight of your leg at the foot less. If I sit in the middle of my drum throne, each one of my feet on the scales, if I put my foot on a scale while I'm seated, weighs approximately 17 to 18 pounds, which means it's not that heavy to lift my leg or do any strokes that involve leg weight. If I put my weight on the edge of the drum throne, it goes up to 36 pounds, nearly double, which means that my feet are going to be tired easier and faster because I have more leg weight I'm picking up with each stroke. Also, since I'm on the edge of the drum throne, I don't have a stable base, which makes it much harder to produce powerful strokes downstairs because I'm constantly always trying to create internal tension in my midsection to not fall over. I am an advocate of heels up and practicing both ankle and hip dominant technique, but I think every drummer should be able to sit in the middle of their drum throne and hover their feet off of the drum throne like I'm in this chair right now and not see any changes in posture because my feet are touching the ground in this video and now I'm lifting them up. And if you're watching the video, there's no change upstairs, which means I have enough center mass over my bum in the middle of the throne and strength to pick my legs up and not be limited so I can do bass drum strokes and not have my posture change. I'm going to say heels up with a stable bass.
That's really cool. Quick story where that question is rooted for me. I've had, where's this drum throne? It's on the side now. It's a rock and sock top. But what I didn't know, this is like 20 years ago in Montreal at a music store, they sold me a Gibraltar bass.
Okay.
And the two, like they go, oh, it's compatible, it's universal. And the rock and sock was always like really wobbly.
Oh, dude.
And so for like 20 years, I've been sitting on a drum throne. And I noticed it once I set up my basement here with the mics. And I'm like, why do I hear the squeaking all the time? And I realized it's my drum throne. And then as I was like, you know, actually paying attention to it, I realized this whole time it's actually like tilting depending on where my posture and weight would lie. So anyways, I bought a new one. And now it's like pure flat and it feels great. But all these years, who knew, right?
Yeah, you know what? I have my first real drum set was a 1992 Pearl Export, those poplar mahogany combos, like the Dupe Rocket Toms. And it came with this throne. I still have the throne. It's in my basement. It's on my Roland kit. And it's got one of those like twist screws to tighten it. And when it gets loose, it does the same thing. And I just crank it up. But that instability is a big problem. Like, I don't know how much we want to dive into this, but drum thrones, right? I get a lot of questions around it. Back injuries and posture are extremely popular conversations for so many different reasons. But if your base is not stable, right? Like this is where like I will tell anyone that wants to buy a drum throne with a slit in the middle or springs underneath it to not buy it unless a physical therapist of spinal therapy, like doctor of spinal physical therapy tells you to purchase it. Because it is ridiculously less stable. If I want
springs,
a drum,
sorry.
So there are drum springs, thrones that have both shock absorbers underneath, and also there's some that have shock absorbers between the throne material and the actual seat adjustment. So there's like shock absorbers, and then there's springs. Yeah,
hydraulics.
Both.
Okay.
I would advocate against both of them.
Gotcha.
And the reason why is that when we're sitting. First of all, sitting for long periods of time is already not a fantastic thing to do. And then when you add additional forces, like moving our legs, it's a lot of stress on our body. When we're seated, there's something called the lumbopelvic rhythm that anybody can look up. And it basically means when your hip runs out of motion, you start to find motion at your lower back. These two things are connected, the hip and the lower back, right? If you're sitting there and you lift your leg up as high as you can, your bum starts to roll forward and your stomach starts to curl because you're going from hip flexion into spinal flexion. Lumbopelvic rhythm. When I'm sitting on this chair and I'm moving my legs, let's forget that. If I'm outside and my car won't start and I want to push the car to get it started, right? Like I got a standard car. I want to give it a shove, right? Yeah. I put my feet on the concrete. I get at the right angle and I give it a push and I can roll it because I have enough of a stable base on the ground and it moves pretty easily. Now, if I was wearing shoes that had springs on the bottom while I was trying to push the car, that would be even less stability. You could imagine it would be wonky and weird, right?
Yeah.
Do you remember those Reebok Retone shoes they made for a while? They were shoes by Reebok that were round on the bottom that were supposed to tone your glutes from wearing them. Do you remember that? Well, imagine trying to push the car while you're on that. That's even crazier. Why would you try and push this ton vehicle with a round base? Okay, now let's say that it was completely snowy out and it was icy on the ground and you tried to push the car. You would slide. You wouldn't be able to move the car because the base of support, your feet, has no friction to push against. It has no stable base. So how could you ever move this thing that weighs a lot? When we start adding memory foam, soft pieces, springs, slits that allow for more motion, tourney pieces, anything that introduces new motions or new elements that decrease stability, it decreases stability of your body, therefore increasing risk.
Wow.
So in my opinion, professionally at this point, and I'm interviewing one of my mentors is a doctor in spinal physical therapy, and I got a call with him next week to validate if I'm right. And if I'm wrong, I'll tell everybody. I'm happy to be.
Yeah.
But in my opinion, I will always recommend, unless I meet you in person, a flat, firm, solid, round top drum throne that does not modify your body position in any way. It allows your body to figure out what it's going to do on the flat surface.
Mm.
It decreases the complexity. It decreases the guessing game. And truthfully, if we can't figure out how to sit on a drum throne without specific gadgets and bits and bobs, I don't think we have any business sitting behind a drum.
Wow.
Does that sound crazy, man?
Crazy, but like logical to crazy.
Right? I mean, if you watch like shock absorbers, right? Yeah. Some people have shock absorbers on their drum throne, the hydraulic thrones. I think it's a really cool idea. But if you think, and you can see me, no one else can on the podcast, if I'm playing bass drum and I'm playing hip strokes up and down, right? And I'm really exaggerating. No one plays like this. This is insane, lifting my leg up all the way. Well, you could imagine the motion is going up and down, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which means that if I was on a bouncy thing, right? If I want to do this and I need my bum to be firm, well, if I was on a bouncy thing, there's a point where that hydraulic would absorb force, but it's also dissipating energy.
Yeah.
Positive to potentially help my back, but negatively to with performance. I used to mountain bike. And if you ever try and go off a jump with a full suspension mountain bike, it sucks because that back shock absorber absorbs all the force and dissipates it. So you don't feel anything, but it can't transfer the energy.
Right.
And if you watch, I won't say anybody, but there's pros you can watch online who are sitting on the hydraulic and they're playing and they're pretty much bouncing the whole time like they're on a horse because once they get bouncing, it creates amplitudes of bounce that prolong going further and further.
Yeah. I've seen
which decreases stability.
Wow. So not that we're looking for a product endorsement or something like that, but would there be like a go-to drum throne that you would purchase for yourself? I know you said like the qualities that we should look for, but is there like a specific one out there on the market?
No affiliation, not sponsored. I would, after trying a lot of drum thrones, my go-to recommendation is the DW9000 flat round top because it is of the material. It is firm, not memory foam. It is a lock screw, so it doesn't spin because even the spinning, and it's a little bit wider than the average drum throne. Now, if you're someone who is not, like I'm 5'11", if you're a little smaller proportion individual, the DW5000 is suffice. I like DW stuff, but I'm not like a big fanboy of theirs necessarily. I have also a DW Roadster up here over there. It's softer. It's fine. I use it for practicing, but the 9000 is my go-to recommendation. It's a moderate price point. It's really sturdy. Everyone that I know who's purchased it has been happy with it. So, and DW, if you want to sponsor me, I'll join the team, but that's just, there you go. It's very cool stuff. It's very solid.
I love it. A couple of more questions for you. You talked about physical conditioning. You know, I want to touch on warm-ups a little bit. And, you know, I remember a drum instructor telling me, you know, you should warm up before you play, stretching things out a little bit. Any, you know, advice on, I'm thinking like church world, where we show up, we have maybe a half hour rehearsal or run through, and then some people just do like one church service, and we have some drummers who play like four services back to back to back to back. What are your thoughts on warm-ups? Should we do them? How do we do them effectively?
Yes, we should do warm-ups. Here's my question for you. What is the purpose of a warm-up?
To get the muscles ready.
To get the muscles ready for performing, right?
Yeah.
And so if we were going to do a warm-up, we would want that to increase our strength probably a little bit, increase our speed a little bit, increase our endurance and stamina, and basically help us with precision. That's fair to say, right?
Yeah.
Well, here's what I would suggest. And if anyone hasn't heard me say this, I will take the time to explain it just a little. The thing you showed me right off the bat was passive stretching. Mm-hmm. If I take my hand, and on the screen, what I'm doing is I'm holding my hand out. If I bring my hand back as far as I can, like I showed earlier, this is as far back as my hand can go currently. If I'm holding a drumstick and I bring my stick back like so, this is as far back as I can go while I'm holding a drumstick. In any of the biomechanics books on the shelf over there beside me, this would be called active range of motion, right? This is the range of motion that I have active availability of. If I took the same distance, which you can see I can't go any further, and I pushed myself further back than I can go, this is called passive range of motion, right? I am now taking my joint further than it can currently actively go on its own. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So my car door can open so far, and then I decide I want to push it further. I try and open it further than it can go. So the reason why I share this is because what you just kind of talked to me about is that, like, we do this, like we got our hands here and then we stretch this back and we stretch this back and we see all these crazy different hand stretches where they're pulling their fingers back and doing all this crazy stuff. Well, passive stretching does have modes in therapeutic world and helping with problems that have been proven to be helpful from physical therapy standards. However, it's also been documented to do the opposite of what you said you want muscles to do, right? You want muscles to be stronger. It actually, from a nervous system and material perspective, decreases strength and decreases potential small amounts of communication to the muscle. So it actually loses force production. When we lose first force production, we actually lose a bit of speed. What something called rate of force development goes down. And if we have less speed and less strength, it is possible that endurance could decrease. And ultimately, the whole passive stretching process beyond what we can do actually makes us weaker, increasing our likelihood of injury. And also, potentially could just injure us from going to the end range. So the reason why I share that is because if anyone in your world is listening, I would really encourage you guys to please stop passive stretching. But what should you do to warm up? There's something called post-activation potentiation. It's a big old mouthful, but everyone's heard of muscle memory.
Yeah.
Muscle memory quite literally post-activation potentiation regards your muscles, if stimulated appropriately, will go back to the strength levels from a rate of force development and force development levels based off of historical contractions. So if I've been able to squeeze 115 pounds with my hand as hard as I can, when I'm walking around day to day, I'm not at that level 100%. But if I do an exercise or a warm-up to stimulate it quickly, my force production and speed will go back very quickly. Nice. So what do? To be quite honest, there's no protocol here, and I literally just recorded a giant course about this because there's so much to do. But the simplest thing that I could recommend for anybody to get started with is to perform what's called an isometric contraction, which is an exercise without motion. And if you want to get past all this gobbledygook, here's what you do. Take your drumstick, for example, to get started, right? Level one is take your drumstick, go back as far as you can. Instead of stretching it backwards like what you would normally do, put your hand on the other side and just try to push the drumstick back into your hand. What instantly happens is if you push back, you'll feel the contraction of all the muscles on the one side of your joint.
Yeah.
So instead of it being a stretch, now it's a contraction. And now it's getting my fingers and my thumbs involved, and you can probably see muscles flexing in the video because I'm contracting. Then on the other end, I go down. I have a practice pad. I should have brought it over. Right? I have a practice pad. I go down into wrist flexion. I push into the practice pad, and I keep pushing down just for a few seconds. And I feel muscles contracting. You want to try this? Go back, push for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, then push down to the table. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and repeat. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then the other one. Good. Next, if we go to a practice pad, here, I'm going to grab a practice pad. You stay right here.
Go for it.
Shout out to Prologics practice pad. Holla. No.
Let's go.
If we talk about practice pads, right? This is a weird angle for me. It's a little bit high, right? If we want to play the drums well, what are all the things we need to do? We have a bunch of different techniques. We have strength. We have speed. So if, what I would suggest you do after you do that potentiation warm-up I just showed you, take a grouping, let's say a group of three. And what I want everyone to do is pick a tempo that is comfortable to start. One, two, three, one, two, three. You can pick any number, but I'm picking three because it's an interesting, right? Three is a few quick strokes in a row, right? Then instead of working yourself to get till you get tired, hit it as hard as you can for the same three. Cool. So now you're just getting a little bit of stimulus. You're staying away from fatigue, but you're playing a subdivision, unison strokes, and then hard as you can. Cool. Once we do a few of those and you start to feel some muscles, that's all I want people to do when they do this, is to feel muscles. The next thing is, how do we work on a little bit of quickness to start preparing us for other rudiments and stuff like that? So if we take the same group of three, and now I fill in the notes in between. Now I'm playing a group of five, which is nothing fancy at all. But now, since it's a group of five, it's a cluster of notes. And I can do a few things with it. I can go quick, speeding it up. And if I've got that speed, I can try and do speed hard. And now I'm not tiring myself out. I'm not fatiguing myself at all. But all I've done in this sweet sequence is I've squeezed down and contracted. I've pushed back and contracted. Squeeze down, contracted, push back and contracted. Then I pick a group of three, could be any rudiment, but group of three, hard, faster, speed. And now we're starting to cook. And then you can do a lot of other things with that, right? Then you can go, do I want to do double strokes? But ultimately, it's not about the what you're doing. It's the idea of, okay, I want to work on making sure my muscles are prepared. So I'm going to hit hard as I can a few times. I want to make sure I've got the speed. So instead of going crazy and like pushing this out, doing small bursts. And then I would just do that for a few minutes. Like, the real goal with this is, like, as you're doing this, is to feel your muscles but not get tired. And you can do it with any rudiment. I mean, if we really wanted to, we could go on and on with this. There's a lot.
That's really
but
cool.
Essentially, I hope it helped, but it's a few isometric contractions and then pick a rudiment and go from there.
Nice. And in a nutshell, how would you do that for your legs and feet? Because they're both important. Obviously, we can't see your feet.
Yeah, I should have set up my other camera. No. To be quite honest, really simply, having someone do the exact same thing. So we're talking about isometric contractions. You could have someone literally, like, you could just stand and do some calf raises, go up under your calf raise, squeeze your calves a couple times, right? Same idea with the isometric. Pick your hip up, push into your hand, pick your hip up, push into your hand. And then honestly, you can do the same thing with the feet. So we're talking about the groups of three.
Yeah.
Right? Heels down, groups of three, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three. And then now ankle dominant strokes, your toes down. So instead of going toe up, now I'm lifting my heel up, so my toes are still down. One, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three. Get comfortable with that. One, two, three, one, two, three, unison strokes. And then do the groups of five. Sure, it's double bass, but it gets both feet prepared.
Yeah.
Go light and then go harder. Well, you can't hear that. Everyone in my gym is going to think I'm nuts. And I would do the same thing. Like, quite honestly, when I do this, I actually, over on the practice pad, do it all in unison with my feet. So hands and feet, one, two, three, one, two, three, da-ga-da-ga-da, 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 hard, da-ga-da-ga-da, 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 da-ga-da-ga-da.
That's so cool. And
it's simple, right? Because it's like, yeah, that seems like, I hope this is coming across on the podcast well, but it's simple because I'm warming up everything in one go. Most non-double bass playing drummers will find their left foot gets tired, but that's cool because if you're working on left foot stuff, it's going to help build up the speed so you can start to do cooler timekeeping stuff.
Love it. Okay, I got one more question for you, and after I'll give you an opportunity to even add whatever else you might want to add, and I have an interesting question for you on that one. But in terms of diet, like, I've heard some drummers say, eat a banana before you play drums, before you head to church, for that potassium or whatever else. Like, Sundays for me, not not only because I'm a pastor, but even when I drum sometimes, I'll preach and play drums. They're long days. What approach from a maybe a diet, you know, a practical thing? What are some things we can do to approach a busy, you know, full on day and have energy to last?
I will confidently say I am not classically trained in nutritional science in any way, but I have several friends who are super nutritionists. On my podcast, I interviewed Dan Garner, who works with UFC athletes. My friend Roland Plankwich works with NHL guys. Like, I have a lot of conversations with these guys. So I'll just share what I personally do from my research. But sure, I would definitely tell everyone here to go, like, Alan Aragon's got great research. His books are up there. It's Flexible Dieting. I would do some research on this. First and foremost, the potassium banana thing, I would put that aside. If you think about, like, we have protein, fats, and carbohydrates, forgetting if carbohydrates are good or bad, that we're talking about, like, between potatoes and white sugar. Or if we think about, protein is a recovery agent that helps with lots of cells in our body repair and grow and develop. It's not a fantastic energy source, although our body can convert it to energy source. We want to try and stay away from that unless you're trying to do something specific in the fasting world, but let's keep that aside.
Yeah.
Fats and carbohydrates are both fantastic energy sources. Glucose is the primary energy source that our skeletal muscle uses. It is required for muscle development and really optimal function at a high level, especially when we get to more energetic aerobic states, which is where most runners have, like, carb tablets, like sugar capsules and different things like that. Not sugar capsules, but things like that. And then fats are a more longer stained form of energy source and are used in our body for a wide variety of different uses. I think using both of them strategically is really important. If you look up how long each energy source in our body lasts, so if you have a gram of carbohydrate versus a gram of fats, my numbers are not going to be correct. So anyone who knows better than me, I apologize. But carbohydrates, the energy source, is a shorter duration, could be 15 to 20 minutes of energy, and it starts to dissipate. And then fats is a longer window. I think it's around 45 minutes. I could be wrong. So if we think about that, fats are good for energy. Carbs are good for energy. Fats give us a little bit longer energy. Carbs are really good. They have shorter energy, but they're also required for a lot of recovery of our skeletal muscle. So what I would encourage people to do is, if they're going to perform, one rule, don't eat a full meal. Like, don't fill your belly, because as soon as your stomach is full, that takes a lot of energy and can cause fatigue and just take away from cognitive functions a little bit. Personally, I find that. I always just try and eat enough so I'm satiated, but I'm not full. I would always recommend, and you guys can choose what you want, to have some form of healthy protein and a healthy fat before doing anything. Like, even before this podcast, knowing I was going to have to cognitively be on the ball, I had a protein bar that I like to have that is low in sugar, and I had a third of a cup of almonds and cashews, which gave me plenty of fats, and then I had a little coffee, and that's it. Beautiful. So I would definitely recommend, before performing the drums, playing, if you got long days, like, stick to the protein, vegetable, fat window, in my opinion. And then once you're completely done and your body's exhausted from drumming or doing the physical things, then you can introduce other healthier forms of carbohydrates. I would definitely recommend sticking. There's a whole conversation window here that it's way outside of my wheelhouse, but I would encourage people to stick to healthy grown carbohydrates, yeah, like fruits, potatoes, rices, things like that, versus breads, sugars, candy bars. But it's important to recognize that most times when you have carbohydrates, there is a small level of fatigue effect that happens after you have them. And anyone that's ever eaten a big pile of sushi or ice cream, you kind of know what I mean. The cognitive function just is, I find, from healthy fats to be better. So I'd say fats and protein before and during busy days. And then at the end of the day, have more carbohydrates, or after you stimulate and exercise. Like, personally for me, when I work out hard, like I train really hard, I will have a banana and a small, like 30 grams of carbohydrates of some sort. And I don't have any fatigue effect. My body requires that energy. Hmm. But I personally think of foods as just chemicals.
Yeah.
Does this chemical serve what I need? And I really try and just focus on healthy chemicals because it makes me perform better. Again, outside my wheelhouse, ballpark information, do your own research. Peter Tia and Andrew Hoopman are brilliant resources and podcasters that have a bunch of information on this. So go read more with them. Alan Aragon, his book's called Flexible Dieting. Also some pretty cool stuff. His book's right there when I'm pointing up. So
yeah, well, I'll research those. I'll link those as well in the show notes.
Cool.
And what are you drinking then when you're playing a lot of drums or even working out? Is it strictly water? Is it like a
ginger water?
Ginger water.
There's no reason why. No. I pretty much drink exclusively water. I do drink. I put a lot of ginger in my water, just my own personal preference. It's good for the stomach and I like it. No fanciness there. Besides that, I have a little bit of electrolytes that I put in my water from a company called ATP and coffee. And that's pretty much all. Oh, yeah. That's all the fluids that goes in my body. Maybe sometimes whiskey, but it's not very often.
So cool. Last question that I have, which maybe it'll open up one more can of worms for you, maybe not. But what's a question that you've never been asked that you would love to answer? So something that you've never been asked, but that you're like, man, I want to talk about this. It might not even be related to anything of this podcast, but something you're very passionate about maybe, but a question you've never been asked, but that you would love to answer.
There's kind of two. There's one around fitness and there's one around cognitive processing. And I'm going to talk about the cognitive one because I've just been thinking about it a lot. I believe playing the drums has some really cool, this is just my current thought process and not validated by any research. So anyone who listens to this, don't light me on fire. But I really believe that playing the drums has some really incredible processes that helps drummers learn faster and interpret information at all differently than other musicians. Maybe not, but just differently, because we have to build up the coordination and dexterity through many parts of our body that we don't typically use. Our feet, for example, doing things with our feet and with control is a very interesting thing. Yeah. At the same time, we get this gigantic wall of auditory sound when we play the drums that is like this huge wash that is so loud, it takes away all the other stimulus. So you're kind of like hyper-focused on the thing in front of you because it's so loud, you can't intake any other information in. And then the auditory processes and the cognitive processes to understand rhythmically what's going on and maintain those rhythms, understand and interpret the rhythm, sing the melodies in our head, and then have it come out all in real time. Like the idea of entering into a flow state where you have four limbs in your mind all coherently working together to create some beautiful piece of music or drum solo or whatever it is, it just blows my mind that a body can even do that. Therefore, right, I think if you practice a lot and learn improvisational skills, that those skills and rhythmic and pattern interpretations and pattern awareness all starts to show up in your day-to-day because you start recognizing patterns in your life. Not necessarily patterns like right, left, left, but patterns of when this happened, this happened, this happens. And it just helps you deal and experience life differently. I really do wholeheartedly swear that my understanding of drums and learning drums at the level I have has helped me learn exercise science and science at all better because I can find patterns in the science that helps me understand it. I understand how I learn from learning how to play the drums at like a high, I believe at a high level. And so what I would say to this little side note is that I think anyone that's a drummer should not just stop at learning songs, but should constantly be figuring out how can I push myself in a way that I like, right? Like how do you, like I think the easiest thing, if I was in a church band, the first thing I would do is try and learn everything left-hand lead because a lot of those songs are relatively simple. But I'll tell you, learning how to go from this to open-handed is a very different experience and it builds new muscles and new coordination and it challenges you. And then could you do the whole thing, but then could you play the whole set with your left foot on the bass drum versus the right? Maybe these sound like crazy challenges, but it takes this entire experience of playing music and then also allows you to develop as a human and challenge yourself. Not a full out thought, to be honest, man, but it's kind of like a fun thing to think that I think playing an instrument or something that involves your entire body and all your senses can help you become a more intelligent and a more aware person. I think it's cool. I don't know though, but fun thought.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. And I'm trying to remember where I saw it or heard it, but I listened to something or saw something very similar to that thought of like, take the ordinary things you do and like flip them a bit and it forces your brain to grow. Anyways, I'm not going to try to expound on that. I think you did a great job.
I'll put drumming aside, but in my day, about, like, if I have 100 clients I see in a month personally that I see regularly, I would say like over half, 50% of them are over the age of 55, if not 60. And I'd say about 20% of them over the age of 70. And why I say that is the 70-year-old, because I've got lots of clients who've been with me for 10 years, and the ones who go from 60 to 70 or 70 to 80 and at 80 years old are still freaking crushing it.
Yeah.
They're not drummers, but they're people who challenge themselves and push themselves outside their comfort zone constantly. They try new things all the time. They don't hurt themselves. They're not risky, but they push themselves. And then the ones who go from 70 to 80 and at 80 years old, they seem like an old person. They don't push themselves. And so I believe that that narrative and that value starts at a younger age. I don't think that you become 70 and go, I'm going to push myself now. Right? I think it starts when you're 20, 30, and 40. And you go, you know what? Yeah. I like when things are hard because I know if it's hard and I work at it, it'll get easy.
Yeah.
And I think drummers have the easiest job because we just make one change and the whole thing changes, right? Right. How many times have you like, hey, I'm going to learn a pattern, and you put like, I'm going to put this note on the and then the whole thing falls apart. Right. <Yeah. laughs> Like, that's just cool. And I think it's just great. I think it has so many, I think it extends far beyond drumming.
Yeah. Among pastors, there's a phrase that we use amongst ourselves, like better at 70. And it's a thing that we say now. I'm 42. And so it's like, I can't wait till I'm 70 to think about health and longevity. So now, I wish I would have done this in my 20s and early 30s. But now that I'm where I am, it's like, okay, what am I doing now to be better at 70? Which lends to that thought that you just shared.
I love it, man. Yeah.
Cool.
Brilliant.
Brandon, thanks for your time, man. This has been one of my favorite podcasts. Like I'm going to have to like re-listen and take notes because it was so deep. But for those of us who want to track with you, like, is there a way where we can continue to learn beyond YouTube? Just let us know, like Instagram, wherever else we can follow you. And if there's any like courses or things where we can subscribe and just learn more.
Yeah. So, I mean, I post daily on Instagram because it's just fun. I literally come in every morning, like, what can I teach people today? And I just improvise. So Instagram, Drum Mechanics, follow me. I try to share stuff every day. I have question box. If you got a question, I'll do my best to answer it as accurately as I can. You know, full disclosure, this is the first time announcing it, but I'll be launching in the next couple months a website called drummechanics.com. Nothing fancy. It'll be a very low subscription service, around $30 a month. But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to make world experts at exercise and technical drumming, healthy drumming, available to people at a really inexpensive price. I'm not trying to create a drum lesson platform, but there will be a reoccurring fitness program called Drum Forever that every month will have new information and new exercises that drummers can do in their practice space with literally just an elastic band. And then there'll be far more advanced information where my friends who are physiologists and physicians will provide also some back-end information and practical stuff. I mean, ultimately, like I mentioned, I don't think I'm a very expensive professional in person if someone hires me. I have no time on my schedule. I have a waiting list for weeks in advance. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm expensive and I'm busy and I've been spent 18 years getting here. But I don't think that drummers should have to spend this kind of price, because I think the information I'm sharing and the availability because of the internet should help people open source learn as much as they can. I want drummers to play forever. I want drummers to never get hurt. And I want drummers to be I want my community of drummers to be the healthiest drummers in the world. So I'd say right now, drum-mechanics is my current really crappy website, and it's got a mailing list. If you want to stay in touch, join that, because I'm going to be offering an offer to my mailing list there first to try and get people excited, a lifetime discount to get started, because I just need enough capital to keep the thing going. And then once it's going, man, it's going to be crazy. I got some world-class drummers on board with me. I got some world-class educators on board. So check out drummechanics.com. If it's March 1st now, it will be up by the summer. And I've got so many courses. I'll be honest, the ergonomics course alone has 20 sections. Wow. So I'm stoked. It's just a matter of time to get it out there. I just need to make sure I got enough awesome stuff that's going to be worth it.